For 2 nights I went out on the marsh with Denzai and her daughter, and we found 2 more crates of guns. Once again I had no way of determining who had left them, or when, though Denzai's oblique statements, careful not to implicate the fishermen I knew usually poached in those areas, implied that they must have arrived sometime in the past month or two. "I'll be glad when the Lord of Mianai gets here," said Lieutenant On to me quietly late one night. "I don't think I should be handling something like this." And in the meantime, I noticed that no one but Denzai went out on the water at night. And in the lower city, no one sat or lay where the shutters might come down. A routine precaution during the rainy season, even though there were safeties to stop them if someone was in their way, but one that was usually ignored in the dry season. The Lord of the Roch arrived in the middle of the day, on foot, a single one of her walking down through the upper city, no trace of her in the tracker logs, and went straight to the Temple of Ikt. She was old, gray-haired, broad shoulders slightly stooping, the almost black skin of her face lined, which accounted for the lack of guards. The loss of one body that was more or less near death anyway wouldn't be a large one. The use of such older bodies allowed the Lord of the Roch to walk unprotected, without any sort of entourage, when she wished, without much risk. She wore not the jeweled coat and trousers of the Rajchai, nor the coverall or trousers and shirt a Shisernan Tan Mind would wear, but instead the Orzian Lungi, shirtless. As soon as I saw her, I messaged Lieutenant On, who came as quickly as she could to the temple, and arrived while the head priest was prostrating herself in the plaza before the Lord of the Roch. Lieutenant On hesitated. Most Rajchai were never in the personal presence of Anandar Mianai in such circumstances. Of course she was always present during annexations, but the sheer number of troops, compared to the number of bodies the Lord of the Roch sent, made it unlikely one would run into her by chance. And any citizen can travel to one of the provincial palaces and ask for an audience, for a request, for an appeal in a legal case, for whatever reason. But in such a case, an ordinary citizen is briefed beforehand on how to conduct herself. Perhaps someone like Lieutenant Skyot would know how to draw Anandar Mianai's attention to herself without breaching propriety. But Lieutenant On didn't. "My lord," Lieutenant On said, hearts beating with fear, and knelt. Anandar Mianai turned to her, eyebrow raised. "I beg my lord's pardon," said Lieutenant On. She was slightly dizzy, either from the weight of her uniform in the heat, or from nerves. "I must speak with you." The eyebrow rose farther.
"Lieutenant On," she said. "Yes?"
"Yes, my lord."
"This evening I attend the vigil in the Temple of Ikt. I'll speak to you in the morning."
It took Lieutenant On a few moments to digest this. "My lord, a moment only. I don't think that's a good idea." The Lord of the Roch tilted her head inquisitively.
"I understood you had this area under control."
"Yes, lord, it's just..." Lieutenant On stopped, panicked, at a loss for words for a second. "Relations between the upper and lower city just now..." She halted again.
"Concern yourself with your own job," said Anandar Mianai, "and I will concern myself with mine."
She turned away from Lieutenant On. A public slight, an inexplicable one. There was no reason the Lord of the Roch couldn't have turned aside for a few urgent words with the officer who was chief of local security, and Lieutenant On had done nothing to deserve such a slight. At first I thought that was the only reason for the distress I read coming from Lieutenant On.
The matter of the guns would be communicated in the morning, just as well as now, and there seemed no other difficulty. But as the Lord of the Roch had walked through the upper city, word of Anander Mianai's presence had spread, as of course it would, and the residents of the upper city had come out of their houses and begun gathering on the northern edge of the Four Temple Water to watch the Lord of the Roch, dressed like an Orzian, stand in front of the Temple of Ikt with the Divine, and listening to the mutterings of the watching Tanmind, I realized that at this particular instant, the guns were only a secondary concern. The Tanmind residents of the upper city were wealthy, well-fed, the owners of shops and farms and tamarind orchards. Even in the precarious months following the annexation, when supplies had been scarce and food expensive, they had managed to keep their families fed. When Jen Shinnan had said a few evenings earlier that no one here had starved, she had likely believed that to be true. She hadn't, nor had anyone she knew well, nearly all of them wealthy Tanmind. As much as they complained, they had come out of the annexation relatively comfortably. And their children did well when they took the aptitudes and would continue to do so, as Lieutenant Skyot had said. And yet, these same people, when they saw the Lord of the Roch walk straight through the upper city to the Temple of Ikt, concluded that this gesture of respect to the Orzians was a calculated insult to them. This was clear in their expressions, in their indignant exclamations. I hadn't foreseen it. Perhaps the Lord of the Roch hadn't foreseen it. But Lieutenant On had realized it would happen when she saw the Divine on the ground in front of the Lord of the Roch. I left the plaza and some of the upper city streets and went to where the Tanmind were standing, a half dozen of me. I didn't draw any weapons, didn't make any threats. I said merely to anyone near me, "Go home, citizens." Most turned away and left, and if their expressions weren't pleasant, they offered no actual protest. Others took longer to leave, testing my authority, perhaps, though not far. Anyone with the stomach to do such a thing had been shot sometime in the last 5 years, or at the least had learned to restrain such a near-suicidal impulse. The Divine, rising to escort Anander Mianai into the temple, cast an unreadable look at Lieutenant On, where she still knelt on the plaza stones. The Lord of the Roch didn't even glance at her. Chapter 7. And then, Striegan said as we ate, latest in a long list of grievances against the Rodchai, there's the treaty with the Presgur. Savardin lay still, eyes closed, breathing even, blood caked on her lip and chin, spattered on the front of her coat. Across her nose and forehead lay a corrective. You resent the treaty? I asked. You'd prefer the Presgur felt free to do as they always have done? The Presgur didn't care if a species was sentient or not, conscious or not, intelligent or not. The word they used, or the concept at any rate, as I understood they didn't speak in words, was usually translated as significance. And only the Presgur were significant. All other beings were their rightful prey, property, or playthings. Mostly they just didn't care about humans, but some of them liked to stop ships and pull them and their contents apart. I'd prefer the Roch not make binding promises on behalf of all humanity, Striegan answered. Not dictate policy for every single human government and then tell us we're supposed to be grateful. The Presgur don't recognize such divisions. It was all or none. It was the Roch extending control yet another way,
one cheaper and easier than outright conquest.
It might surprise you to learn that some high-ranking Rajchai dislike the treaty as much as you do.
Striegen raised an eyebrow, set down her cup of stinking fermented milk. Somehow I doubt I'd find these high-ranking Rajchai sympathetic.
Her tone was bitter, slightly sarcastic. No, I answered, I don't think you'd like them much. They certainly wouldn't have much use for you.
She blinked and looked intently at my face as though trying to read something from my expression.
Then she shook her head and made a dismissing gesture.
Do tell.
When one is the agent of order and civilization in the universe, one doesn't stoop to negotiate, especially with non-humans, which included quite a number of people who considered themselves human, but that was a topic best left undiscussed just now. Why make a treaty with such an implacable enemy? Destroy them and be done.
Could you? Striegen asked, incredulous. Could you have destroyed the Presger?
No. She folded her arms, leaned back in her chair.
So why any debate at all?
I would think it was obvious, I answered. Some find it difficult to admit the Rajchai might be fallible, or that its power might have limits.
Striegen glanced across the room toward Saevarden. But this is meaningless. Debate. There's no real debate possible.
Certainly, I agreed. You're the expert.
Oh-ho, she exclaimed, sitting straighter. I've made you angry.
I was sure I hadn't changed my expression. I don't think you've ever been to the Rajchai. I don't think you know many Rajchai, not personally, not well. You look at it from the outside, and you see conformity and brainwashing. Rank on rank of identical silver-armored soldiers with no wills of their own, no minds of their own. And it's true, the lowest Rajchai thinks herself immeasurably superior to any non-citizen. What people like Saevarden think of themselves is past bearing.
Striegen made a brief amused snort.
But they are people, and they do have different opinions about things.
Opinions that don't matter. Anander Mianai declares what will be, and that's how it is.
That was a more complicated issue than she realized, I was certain. Which only adds to their frustration. Imagine your whole life aimed at conquest, at the spread of Rajchai space. You see murder and destruction on an unimaginable scale, but they see the spread of civilization, of justice and propriety, of benefit for the universe. The death and destruction, these are unavoidable byproducts of this one supreme good.
I don't think I can muster much sympathy for their perspective.
I don't ask it. Only stand there a moment and look. Not only your life, but the lives of all your house and your ancestors for 1,000 years or more before you are invested in this idea, these actions. Ahmat wills it. God wills it. The universe itself wills all this. And then one day someone tells you maybe you were mistaken, and your whole life won't be what you imagined it to be.
Happens to people all the time, said Striegen, rising from her seat. Except most of us don't delude ourselves that we ever had great destinies.
The exception isn't an insignificant one, I pointed out.
And you?
She stood beside the chair, her cup and bowl in her hands.
You're certainly Rajchai. Your accent, when you speak, Rajchai.
We were speaking her own native language.
Sounds like you're from the Gerentate, but you have almost no accent right now. You might just be very good with languages. Inhumanly good, I might even say.
She paused.
The gender thing is a giveaway, though. Only a Rajchai would misgender people the way you do.
I'd guessed wrong. I can't see under your clothes, and even if I could, that's not always a reliable indicator.